EWA-517, do you want to report a UFO?
Negative. We don't want to report.
Ares 31, do you wish to report a UFO? Over.
Negative. We want to report one of those either.
Ares 31, do you wish to file a report of any kind of it?
I wouldn't know what kind of report to file, sir.
Ares 31, me neither.
There 71 Papa Golf, go ahead.
And was anybody at above us to pass us like 30 seconds ago?
There 71 Papa Golf, negative.
Okay. Stop this. It's a UFO.
Yeah. Hey, it's Merge 295. Yeah, something just passed over. Don't know what it was, but it's at least 2,000-3,000 feet above us. Yeah, it passed right over the top of us.
911.
You guys busy? Do we just call about the UFOs that are?
Mm-hmm.
They're out there, taking airplanes.
And it is such. Bob, I swear to God, four calls in on an unidentified object over Liberty. Four calls on an unidentified flying object.
All right, take a look. All right, we'll check it out.
Welcome to UFO Chronicles, a place where people share their experiences of the strange and unexplained. If you've had an encounter and would like to be on the show, you can email me at ufochronicles@gmail.com. Hello and welcome to the show, everyone, wherever in the world you are joining us from tonight. I hope you've all had a good week. Now, this episode, we have the company of Stuart Davis from Colorado, and he will be sharing his encounter of a mantis being and some of his other anomalous events. Stuart is also the host of the podcast Aliens and Artists and is founder of the Experiencer Group, a support site for experiencers. Now, some of you may understand how busy I get with this show, so if you have emailed me, please be patient. I will get back to you. Some weeks I can get hit by emails in the triple figures. And if you have received a reply from me and not yet followed up, please get back in touch. Before we hear from Stuart, I want to thank all those that have left 5-star ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts recently. HXPXH, LizB1, Mike Breedlove, Aoife60, E to the Z, Joseph G, Valley Girl, Big Money, Razor Stage, Gabe Astridge, Greemech77, Keg Mix, and Carl Bird. Thank you to all of you. These reviews really help the show to attract new listeners and guests. So message me a postal address and I will get a bumper sticker of the podcast out to you. If you enjoy the show and you would like to help support the podcast on Patreon, you can do this for as little as $1 a month. Head on over to www.patreon.com/UFO Chronicles Podcast. You can also find a link in the description of this episode below. Any help is very much appreciated. Now, on with the show. Hello, Stuart, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Nick. Love the show. Very glad to be here.
And it is great to have you with us. And you're calling from Boulder, Colorado.
Boulder, Colorado. Tucked right in the foothills here. Not too far from the Flatirons.
Now, Stuart, you are an experiencer and you've had experiences over the years. But would you like to take us back to 2010, please, Stuart?
Absolutely. Would be happy to. So there's a tiny bit, a very brief bit of history, which is germane to the larger story, which began in 2010, which just briefly, I had a lot of fevers growing up. Most of my childhood was characterized by those in the range of 104 to 105 degrees. And because of the frequency of the fevers, I became weirdly fascinated with them. I've always been a bit of a state chaser, bit of an altered state orientation came with my constitution. So when I would get these fevers as a kid, I would have really interesting experiences to me, to my mind and body inside of these fever states. And over time, I tried to develop a facility with them. The pattern would be I'd go into a fever and I would have something interesting or insightful occur. And I, in the fever, would remind myself, would admonish myself to remember what was happening. Remember this. This is important. But then the fever would break and the memory would be gone without fail. So I never developed a reliable strategy to get that outcome. Fast forward to age 23, I began meditating. I discovered Zen Buddhism and got really involved in that community. And after meditating for a while and going on some of these longer retreats called sessions, where you would sit, you know, between 8 or 10 or 12 hours a day staring at a wall, that strangely evoked this somatic, surreal recollection of my fever states from when I was a child. And in the meditative states, I thought, I really need to combine these. I would love to combine a deep meditative state with a fever state, just because A, they'd both been important in my life up until that time, and B, I had never heard of it before. I'd never been aware of those two things being put together, and I just experimentally wondered what would happen if they were combined in a kind of like inner mad scientist fashion. So I had that notion at the age of 23, let's combine these. And then strangely, around that time, my fevers stopped. And for reasons to this day I don't understand, I didn't have fevers from the age of 23 up until the year 2010, which brings us to your question and what is essentially the originating event in my experiences, kind of a ground zero. So in 2010, it's New Year's Eve, and my wife is out having fun and cavorting. I'm home sick. It's the first time I've been sick in a very, very long time in this real acute fashion. I had a high fever and was alone in the house, basically fevering my way through New Year's Eve. About 11:30 rolls around, and I have this spontaneously recollecting at the age of 23, this impulse of, hey, I should try to combine meditation with a fever. So around 11:30 that night, I thought, oh, this is great. I finally have an opportunity to do this again. I forgot about this. So I began meditating. And as midnight approached, that time was close, I thought it would be really cool to usher in the new year with something special. So I'd been meditating for whatever, 20, 25 minutes. And so spontaneously, as midnight hit, I just conveyed with my depth of being to the universe, to no one in particular, I want to meet my guides. I want to meet my guides. Show me my guides. Who are my guides? In that real animistic sense of asking the fever a question. And I don't know what I was expecting. I didn't have anything definite formulated, but I suppose if I did have a bias, I would have imagined maybe I was going to see some dead Buddhist monks or Buddhist deities or something, because I'd been practicing in that lineage. But what happened was, at the end of my bed, this 8-foot tall manted entity appeared and adorned in a purple indigo robe with a high collar. It just was there at the foot of my bed, and it instantly shot me full of it felt like a fire hose, like an invisible fire hose of pops and clicks and frequencies, but all of it substantive. There was content there, but none of it was verbal. And it all happened so fast, I didn't really even have a moment to react. It was just there. It shot me full of this current, and it was like being electrified, but it wasn't painful. I was not in pain, but I felt totally suffused or immersed or arrested with this signal that it was transmitting, which didn't go on for a long time, 10 or 15 seconds. And when that was done, it felt like it somehow deposited into my head this one phrase in English: remember who you work for. Just like that was deposited right in my head in English. I heard that. And then it was over. I don't even remember how the thing, if it vanished or it left. That's the last of the memory that I have. And the whole event from its arrival was under a minute, I'm pretty sure. And the next morning I woke up, the fever was gone, but the vivid, distinct recollection of that visitation remained in full force. I was totally beside myself with having nowhere to put that as an experience. It didn't have a category. I didn't have any idea what to make of it at all. I went to tell my wife about it, and luckily I did that because the force, the passion and emotion that was attending me relating this to her really burned into her, and she never forgot that very much. And so I at least had this fresh next morning. I related to her in as full detail as possible what had happened. God bless her. You know, she didn't try to interpret it or offer any feedback. She was just like, huh, okay. I mean, she's been married to me for a long time and a lot of weird shit's gone down in my life. So it's not utterly far afield, but certainly singular and unique. And she just basically listened to it, put it in her memory, and, you know, we moved on. And I moved on as well because it just sat as this isolated oddity in my personal history. And so years went by and it didn't re-emerge as an influence or orienting presence in my life again until we moved to Amsterdam. This is 5 years later. I'm living in Amsterdam and I'm on a boat. I have a couple of years. I'm not allowed to work in Amsterdam while we're living there. Didn't have the right permits. And so I had a lot of time to just create. And I began writing a movie. The movie's called Mantis. And it's about this victim of sex trafficking who has a paranormal awakening. And she falls under the sway or enters into a relationship with these 8-foot-tall alien mantid entities. She's Russian. It's in Russian. Of course, while this is happening, I'm like, oh, yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah, I've kind of forgot about this or hadn't thought about it. And this, as I'm writing the film, a vague sense that in ways I can't ascertain or elucidate that the film is related to the visitation in 2010, whatever that entity shot into my body is somehow connected to this movie, or at least the creative impulse toward writing it and its content in some way. But again, I finished that and set it aside, thinking I'll never do anything with this. It's perhaps like a cathartic creative exercise to help me on subconscious level or in a liminal fashion work through the experience in 2010. I don't know. I just set it aside. So a few years later, we moved back to the US and we're back in my house here that I haven't been in for a while here in Boulder. And I'm out on the lawn, the yard. It's actually a park. It's not my lawn, but it's right in front of my house. And I'm lying on my back. It's just getting dark, but there's nothing in the sky. And I'm lying on my back in the grass waiting for my dog to go to the bathroom. And I see this orb, spherical, white, luminous orb moving horizontally across the sky, just above the tree line from where I'm laying. And this is early evening. There's nothing else in the sky at all. The orb, it's moving slowly enough that I actually have the thought, I reach out my arm and I use my fingers, my fingertips to determine what its size is in relationship just to my finger in the sky, which is it's the size of my pinky fingernail held out at arm's length. And it moves across a large portion of the sky. I went back later and tried to reconstruct this. I'm not an astronomer or any kind of sky specialist, but it looked like it roughly was about 33 degrees of the night sky that it went horizontally across and then it stops dead and remains still just above and to the right of my house, actually. And when it stops, I am electrified. As it remains stationary, then my body begins to react and it stays there for a minute or two, totally stationary, and I'm riveted. And then it starts to move again, but this time it moves vertically straight up at a 90 degree angle from its previous path. And the fact that it stopped and then moved at that right angle just sends a piss quiver to my soul. Pardon the expression, but it really, I felt frozen. And I simultaneously was really excited. Like I was looking around. I wanted someone to share the experience with me. I wanted to call for a neighbor or something. And I wanted to go look for someone. There was no one else. It's just me and my dog in this park and I couldn't find anyone. And so I think I'll go inside, but then I'm have this fear if I leave, it's going to vanish. So I kept staying and watching it. And while that's going on, perhaps just as a function of the fact that I'm alone. I couldn't really say for sure, but it keeps doing these. It will stop its vertical ascent and remain stationary for a minute or two, and then it will move left in a horizontal 90 degree new arc, always moving at these 90 degree. It's not really making a grid, but it repeatedly would go horizontal, stop, go at a 90 degree angle up, stop, go horizontal left, stop, 90 degree angle up, stop. So it's making this pattern path behavior that immediately disqualifies it from a lot of categories. While that's going on, I get the feeling that this is a performance for me, or that I have the feeling clearly that there's an intelligence navigating in my gut. I'm like, I feel like this thing is performing. I feel like this is like a show for me or something. Like it's, so I finally watch it long enough. I didn't have my phone on me or anything. I was just literally thought I was going to go out and have my dog pee and go back in. So after maybe 10 minutes or so, I go inside and I grab my daughter, one of my daughters, the one that I know is not going to be like roll her eyes. Not that my other daughter would roll her eyes, but I have one daughter who's the most inclined to explore these kinds of ideas or experiences. So I grab her and I go up on the deck. I happen to have cameras set up on the deck with very long lenses, not for this purpose. I had been filming something else, a documentary, totally separate show, had nothing to do with the paranormal or the anomalous, but they happened to be sitting on the deck and they had long lenses. And so I get my daughter and we go up and we start watching this thing through the long lenses. And as she's watching it through those lenses, the one orb, which again is still the only thing in the sky, it's so huge. I've never seen anything that big in the sky aside from the moon and the sun. And she's watching it and the one orb breaks into three orbs and they form a horizontal line, equidistant. She starts freaking out. And this again amplifies my feeling, of course, that there's an intelligence at play here. I still have no idea what I'm looking at, neither does she, but both of us are like, wow, that is really incredible. That's crazy. It's just now it's three horizontal dots. So I make her go get my wife and my other daughter. My whole family comes up on the deck and my oldest daughter and I force my wife and my other daughter to look through, because both of them are like, this is so, oh God, whatever. We're watching a movie. We don't want to come up here. They look through and I make them describe without any instruction or without any leading from me, just describe what you see. See three bright orbs. See three spheres in horizontal. Everybody sees the same thing. So my wife and my youngest daughter are just like, cool, you guys have fun. They go back downstairs and my oldest daughter and I remain on the roof. And as we keep watching this thing, those three orbs shift again into a triangle formation, which is a perfect, again, equidistant formation. Now, what was wild is you could only see the triangle formation of the orbs through the long lens. With the naked eye, they reduced to one orb. So the person not looking through the lens, you could only really see it as one point of light, still remaining the size of my pinky fingernail held at arm's length. But if you look through this long lens, clearly three distinct orbs in this triangle formation at the end, horizontal formation previously. But it stayed in that formation so long that we finally got bored and we went to bed. I mean, we watched it for an hour and 40 minutes, probably including my time on the grass. You know, it was almost 2 hours and it was long enough. So we went to bed. And my chief takeaway from that was this vague ruminating notion that I could never say how or why, but I just connected it to the event in 2010. Maybe because those were just two of the strangest things that had ever happened to me. Maybe it's that simple, but intuitively, I just felt like those things are connected. I don't know how. So I was doing my stuff as an artist in Los Angeles a while later. I meet a producer and she is shopping for films. Her name is Siona Van Dyke. So she is buying movies and she finds out about this movie Mantis. She goes really crazy for it, wants to buy it. I actually try to talk her out of it. I've written, I don't know, 10 or 15 movies, and I felt like the Mantis film was perhaps the least makeable or marketable. It just is, it's a very, very, very strange story. And so I kind of tried to talk her out of it. That only seemed to make her more determined. She ends up buying it, and that purchase of that film Mantis by Siona and this company called 5HT2A in Los Angeles. That ends up being the segue to what is the only synchronicity storm I've ever had in my life. I mean, I've had some synchronicities, but this film and us beginning to work on it, because when she bought it, she started hiring other people to work on it. That brought in this whole crazy succession of synchronicities that to this day, I and everyone who else was involved in just find comically, cosmically, ontologically baffling. So the first of these began, she'd bought the film, and I'm on the phone at the dog park again. My dog figures peripherally in a lot of this in a really funny way. He's threaded through all of this. He's sort of like the being there. Who's the guy in the being there film? Or the forest? Maybe my dog's like the Forrest Gump of the anomalous. But anyway, I'm at the dog park with my dog, and I'm on the phone talking about Mantis, the movie, with Siona, the producer. And I'm kind of complaining to her and just saying, oh my God, this is going so slow. Like, how long is this going to take to make this movie? And I told you shouldn't have started with Mantis. And as I'm saying that, a praying mantis insect flies up and lands on my left foot. And I stop mid-sentence and look down at, and a shiver ran through my body. To this point, I had never seen a praying mantis insect in the wild. Of course, I've seen them all over the place in popular culture and whatnot, but I'd never seen one in the wild. This one, in the middle of my sentence about the Mantis movie with the producer, flies up, lands on my foot. I'm like, I gotta go because I need to take pictures. Take pictures of this mantis. It's looking at me. Anyone who's had mantis insect pets or interacted with one with the wild, no, they're a very unusual kind of insect. Like they will look at you and it feels like someone's looking at you. There's someone in there is the experience. And so I'm giddy taking pictures of this insect. I'm like, holy shit, what a synchronicity. Like, wow. And I video and all of that. And it stays for maybe a minute and flies off to a tree. I follow it around for a bit and it ends up flying away. That mantis insect physically landing on my person while I'm having a conversation about the movie ends up being the first of more than a dozen of exactly these events where a mantis insect physically showed up every time we hired someone to work on the movie. So the next was this producer named Eleonora Granada Jenkins. And by the way, I've recorded all of these. All of this exists in a doc form. Like I captured all of this to document all of it because it's so ludicrous. If you don't hear it coming from these people's mouths personally, I wouldn't believe that all of this happened. But Eleonora Granada Jenkins comes on to the film as a producer. Day one, she's waiting for her script to be delivered by Siona, the producer. She's at this huge mansion in Bel Air where she lives. And she goes out to open the front door because she thinks she hears Siona coming up. And she opens the door and there is a mantis insect on the welcome mat of her front door. And she just looks down and she's never seen one before in real life. And she's freaking out, goes to get her husband. She's like, why? I'm supposed to be having this mantis movie and this mantis insect is here. So that happens like domino effect. We send a script to a cinematographer. He opens the door and there's a mantis insect on the script the day we deliver it. And he picks it up from his front doorstep. This other producer, Serena, another producer on the film, this happened to her on three separate occasions. One of which was the day she got the script, but another, she was walking, hiking with her sister, talking to her sister about the mantis synchronicities that had been going on. And her sister stopped her in her tracks and said, hold on, look. And they look down and on the path in front of their feet is a white praying mantis between the two of them on the path they're walking. Like none of us even knew a white praying mantis existed. They had to go home and Google that. And again, all of these counts recorded in their first person. I've got it all documented. Happened to her three times. Maybe my favorite one of the more than 12, to distill this to one which had carried a level of emotional punch to it that made it really meaningful for us. Joel Sadlick, who is a producer with 30 plus years, made, you know, more than 100 movies. Mantis was the last film he ever worked on. He was hired to work on our movie as a line producer. He had terminal cancer. He didn't tell anybody. He just worked on our film. And none of us knew he was ill until he died. And when his wife flew to Cedar Rapids, Iowa to go to his funeral. She lands at the airport. And by the way, she'd been very much in the fold on Mantis as well. Like the two of them kind of come as a team. So she was fully cognizant of all of this Mantis magic being sprinkled about. And when she landed in Cedar Rapids, got out of the airport, went to the car to get into the car to drive to the funeral, she closes the door, and on her side, the passenger side in the front, this huge praying mantis insect lands on the rear view mirror. And her sister instantly is like, "That's Joel. That's Joel." And she's definitely hit by this. They drive, get on the interstate, 80 miles an hour. This mantis insect holds on to that rear view mirror. She said it was on there for at least 5 minutes while they're on the interstate going 80 miles an hour. And it happened to her again at the memorial service. They're passing around these rocks of all these people that had died from his disease at this particular wing of this hospital. And each deceased person, their name is painted onto a rock, handed to their loved one. So they paint Joel's name on this rock and they hand it to his wife, his widow. And she's holding it, and a praying mantis flies up and lands on the rock, which again is impossible. But all of it, you hear all of this in her first person account, her voice. It's all in this audio documentary we made, expressly because it's totally unbelievable. This happened more than a dozen times, not to every person. I think we had 20 people working on the film at the height, and it happened to 12 of them, and some of them had multiples. So depending on how you want to number it, 12 plus out of 20. And, you know, happened to our makeup and hair person. It happened to our set designer just over and over again. In one instance, the day we had hired the hair and makeup person, she was lying in the grass somewhere on another shoot, and like a dozen baby, just freshly hatched new praying mantis insects landed all over her body, took all these photos. So I have all of that. I have all the photos. I have all the videos. Each of these people this happened to, they took the photos on the spot. It's rigorously, extensively documented. But suffice to say that, A, this is just not uncommon. You know, you don't have to look very deep or very long into experience or life, into experience or reality, to know that there is a whole liminal intelligent operant factor in this stuff that we don't understand. You know, to this day, before I get to the next part of what happened with these experiences, which grew more personal, but I couldn't tell you necessarily to this day what those synchronicities meant. They certainly feel profoundly momentous. I would say the part I'm clear about in it is that an intelligence is there. Something intelligent is working those insects. I would venture a guess that it's the mantid entity or the mantid entities. But where does it lead? Well, it didn't lead to the film being made. It didn't lead, I don't know. I don't, like, it doesn't necessarily lead somewhere. I don't have a nice, clean conclusion to this, which is like, and the film was made and we went to Cannes and then that didn't happen. Just was more like a haunting that swept through our lives, and that we all kept looking at each other like, what the F is happening? It happened so often and for so long that we got over it and we learned to expect it. And the last three or four people that we hired, we knew it was going to happen, and it did. And we were almost like shrugging our shoulders because we didn't know what to do about it. We knew at that point that it wasn't like we're going to win the lottery. So that part remains really mysterious.
Are you intrigued by Paranormal Talk Radio? You'll love the new Paranormal Radio app from TalkStream Live. You'll find a great selection of talk shows covering UFOs, ghosts, strange phenomena, and much more. Download the Paranormal Radio app now and start listening to the very best in paranormal talk entertainment, including the network you're listening to right now, the Paranormal Radio app, free in Google Play and the iOS App Store.
The Experiencer Group is a private gathering place for those who've had anomalous experiences, such as precognition, out-of-body, near-death, clairvoyance, ghosts, UFOs, past life, lucid dreams, and more. Within the site, members can join groups specific to their interests and access original content, including exclusive sessions where you interact directly with important luminaries and ask them your burning questions. Members also have confidential meetups with others from around the world and get access to in-person events, exclusive podcasts, and video series. No trolls, no stigmas, just intelligent, deep people like you who've had extraordinary experiences. Go to theexperiencergroup.com to become a member.
Eventually, what ensued and deepened from that was I ended up back in my house in Boulder, and the synchronicities did lead me to feel moved to at least ask the question more deeply. So it was a strong enough reminder for me to begin to think like, okay, what was the deal with that visitation in 2010? And what's up with the UFO and what's up with these synchronicities? So I just basically decided I'm going to make a little effort. And I began to wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, which is a practice that's not necessarily unique to the anomalous. This is something that meditators do in some traditions. And so I began getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning and going up on my rooftop deck and meditating and basically trying to do like a one-man CE5, one-man phone call to the mantid entity, being like, hey, can you come back? Can we do this like in a more structured, conscious way? And I did this for a few weeks and nothing happened. Nothing. The synchronicity stopped. I didn't get any visitations and I got really sleepy. It was detracting from my sleep life. And so I stopped doing that. And then on January 19th, 2018, because I do keep a really fastidious diary of everything and have for more than a decade, I find it to be totally critical in not necessarily coming to some big conclusion or insight, but having better memory, recollection, and clues. Just creates a better assembly of clues. So I do know that it was January 19th, 2018. I wake up at 3:33 in the morning, which is cheesy. It's as cheesy as it sounds. I don't even like report like the details around the 3:03 and the 3:13 and the 3:33. I wish that it wasn't that way. It sounds like a 12-year-old boy is writing these experiences, but that's unfortunately that is the time. So I wake up at 3:33 and there are coyotes going crazy in my neighborhood. It's a pack of them. And I sit up in bed only because you never hear coyotes. I never hear coyotes. I live in a pretty urban area and it's not, you know, there's not a coyote territory close to where I live. Never hear them. So I just sit up and I'm like, wow, that's really wild. There's like a coyote is like a block away, it sounds. They're going crazy. And then they just stop on a dime, silence. And immediately after they stop, a beat or two, these loud reverberations, which are sound just like a massive tuning fork, is being struck outside over the top of my house. In particular, it sounds like the tuning fork is being struck in reverse, or it's being played in reverse. It sounds just as though, like if you go into an audio program and you reverse a clip, it's a tuning fork in reverse floating over the top of my house. And that totally gets my attention because as a music producer, that's one of my favorite tricks. It's always been one of my favorite approaches to creating a surreal atmosphere within a song or a work. And so much so that it's a running joke among the artists and the producers that I work with. They make fun of me for this because I do it so much. I've pushed repeat on this over the years and they know to just throw things in reverse into the mix because I'm going to be asking that for that anyway. And it's also a feature in a constructed language that I created as an art project, as a thought experiment called Is. And in this language, words are directional. The meaning of a word depends on which direction you point it. So every word in this language is reversible. The word for yes pointed the other direction, spoke in the other direction. Reversed is the word for no, and so on ad infinitum. So when I hear this tuning fork over my house in reverse, it feels really personal. It feels super intimate to me, hyper specific. And I just sit there listening to it, having no idea what to make of it. I feel spooked, but fascinated. And after a while, it stops. And as soon as it stops, the coyotes go crazy again. And then they barking and howling and losing their shit. They like recede out of the sonic range. And I sit there nonplussed. And I put earplugs in my ears and I just go back to bed. Because I really like have no clue. I'm baffled. So I just put earplugs in, go back to sleep. Same thing happens again on January 29th, 2018, except this time I wake up at 3:13 in the morning. Same series, tuning forks over the house. I get out of bed, but this time I go to the door. I have a bedroom door, which opens onto my lower deck. The lower deck sits about 15 or 20 feet below the upper deck, and I open it, stick my head out, and the sound is clearly hovering just above my deck, moving a little bit, but it's always staying within the circumference of the rooftop deck. And I want to go up there and investigate, but I'm unable to. I'm afraid, and it's a real weird fear. I have no idea what there is to be afraid of. It's just sound of a reversed tuning fork over my house. So I turn to my dog. I have a 100-pound Doberman Pinscher protection dog. I mean, we literally got this dog from a breeder as a house protector. And my dog refuses to get off the bed. He, like, this dog, you can't pry him off of my body. He's literally within 2 or 3 feet of me 23 hours a day. Like, unless I go to the gym, he's glued to me. So his ears are perked up and he's tracking the sound. You can watch his head moving and tracking it, but he will not get off the bed, much less go outside. And the rest of the neighborhood is just dead silent. And again, I have this weird disconnected sense that these tuning fork things are connected to my meditation sessions that I've been doing on the deck, but it doesn't make sense because I'm not on the deck anymore. I stopped meditating and I gave up. Nothing happened. Nonetheless, I am embarrassed and feeling just quasi-paralyzed, trepidation. And so, repeat, I put earplugs in, I go back to bed, I feel like an idiot. And the next day I wake up and feeling that embarrassment, I'm like, this is totally ridiculous. I'm behaving so, this is not rational, but more than not being rational, it's like, I had been on the deck trying to summon this thing back and it's come back and now I'm not even able to go outside. This is ridiculous. So I just kind of brace myself, you know, like suck it up, get some balls, start going back up on the deck again, 3 o'clock in the morning, meditating, and nothing happens. I never succeed through meditation and my like one man CE5 of nothing happens. It's just like totally uneventful. So again, I quit. And say, F it. You know, like, this is stupid. Fast forward to March 9th, 2018, 3:03 in the morning. My wife and I both wake up. And heretofore, I've not been looping her in on this because my wife is not into this stuff. She's not dismissive of it. She's not any kind of skeptic or debunker or dismisser. She recognizes and respects, believes my accounts and experiences, but she's not into it. It's not like a passion or interest for her. But we both wake up because the coyotes are going crazy again, and they're so loud that it wakes us both up. So we're both sitting there listening to these coyotes, and then the dead silence, just like on a dime. Again, it's like someone mutes them. It's not like they just trickle off. It's like someone pushes mute, and the coyotes stop all simultaneously in an instant. So thank God my wife hears this with me. And when that happens, when they stop like that, like they've been muted, we look at each other and I'm like, told ya, see, like, you know, I'm so glad she's awake with me for this. So this time after the coyotes stop, instead of a tuning fork, it is the sound of a hearing test. And another part of my backstory that's germane to this is that when I was a kid, those high fevers were connected to ear infections. I had chronic ear infections all my life as a young person. They came with the fevers. I had tubes. I think it was at least six times over the course of, you know, between ages 7 and 14 or 13 or something. So because of that, because of chronic ear infections and illnesses, I was always in ear, nose, and throat specialists getting hearing tests. They were always trying to gauge how much hearing I'd lost because my eardrums had broken and just all kinds of bad things had gone down in my inner ear. So hearing tests, of course, for me emotionally as a young person, were braided into surgeries and high fevers and, you know, fear of doctors and shoving things into my inner ear all the time. Like, I hated that stuff. And hearing tests were one of the indelible characteristics or features that came with that part of my life. So now, sitting with my wife at 3:03 in the morning, coyote stopping, hearing test starting, I look at her and I'm just like, oh my God, this is so, like, they're plucking this out of my, this is so personal. It's like transgressively personal. It's invasive. That, I mean, it's so weird to feel on the heels of that reverse tuning fork. I know that whatever is doing this, and my wife is hearing it with me, and I'm forcing her, like, you tell me right now what you hear before I tell you what I hear so that I can corroborate and know I'm not crazy. So then my fear makes more sense, because I'm like, whatever is doing this, I really feel it's plucking these personal specificities from my tangled youth and brain and memory, and it's displaying it. It's performing it over my house for me and my wife and my dog. And so I want to go outside on the deck again, and I get up and I go to the door and I open the door and I'm like, let's go outside, you know? My dog, again, ears up, tracking it, refuses to get off the bed. This is a dog that like lives genetically. It will go after anything remotely out of step in our home environment. It's genetically bred as a protection dog. It won't get off the bed. It's looking at the door like it's death itself. I'm standing on the threshold of the door. Dog won't come. I'm like trying to get my wife to come. And she's like, no, I'm not doing that. Leave me alone. I'm going back to bed. She literally puts earplugs in, lays down in bed, and puts a pillow over the top of her head. So then it's just me. And I do the same, like, terribly. In retrospect, looking back at all of these events, and these are three among many that occurred. I won't go through them all because these exemplify it just fine. But standing there, I just felt embarrassed and shameful but unsettled, deeply unsettled. And I did the same thing. I was just like, well, screw it. If no one's going to go out on the deck with me, I'm just going to go back to bed too. And I put earplugs in and I go back to bed. And that was the end of, it wasn't the end. That was a fine enough pinnacle on those kinds of nocturnal events, which I documented very carefully in each instance. But what it led to from there in the next stage of the experience and my attempt to make any kind of sense of it was I really began to feel that feeling of like, God, I really hope I'm not losing my shit. Like, I really hope I'm not disassembling and losing some anchor point or foundation. And so I wanted to form basically a blind shamanic test. I went out and hired four different shamanic healers and practitioners, and I repeated the same inquiries with all four of them because I felt that if I could get the same results from four different shamanic practitioners who didn't know that I was working with the other ones, then I could, with greater confidence, rely upon the outcomes of those sessions in so much as the ones that were common among the four of them. So whatever they agreed on and had consensus on, then I would grant a higher degree of confidence in, let's say, about what these events were, what the mantid entity was, why this is happening. So in one particular instance of working with one of these shamanic practitioners, she said, you need, she was speaking to this mantid entity, basically doing like a shamanic journey and interacting with it. And it essentially told her, I don't want to talk to you. I want to talk to him. Like, I want to go, I want him to channel me. I want him to be the one that receives the communication. So she kind of came back and said, this being wants you to channel it. She wants you to, it wants you to write out your questions, give them to me. Then I'll help you learn how to channel. And then you'll channel it and I'll ask your questions to it. And that's how you'll get the answers you want. That's how this thing wants you to go about it. So I'm pretty spiritually promiscuous, to say the least. I'm not some goody two shoes or super conservative about these things, but I am pretty conservative about just offering up my body as a housing vessel for some intelligence to come through that I haven't vetted or have, you know, don't know from Adam in a lot of ways, in a lot of senses. So I was pretty reluctant and I debated it, really ruminated on for a long time. I struggled with it. And in the end, at this point in my life, this particular juncture, my curiosity and my desperation for more information was stronger than my fear. The fear was still very strong, but I got a lot of assurances from the shaman. She was like, don't worry, I got your back. She did a lot of, I should add, she did a ton of prep work on this. She did probably 2 sessions on her own, just determining that this being was what it was presenting itself to be to the best of her ability. And because that concorded with the information I'd gotten from the other shamanic practitioners, it was one point upon which there was consensus. Because of that, I agreed to channel. So on March 30th of 2018, we do this. We set up this session and the shaman guides me through a set of techniques, which she had also been doing in anticipation of the session. And because I've been meditating at this point for like, I don't know, almost 30 years or something, it wasn't too tricky or it wasn't very difficult. Wasn't a lot of obstacles to get into the altered state and drop into the register that this being had as a preferred entry point. And when I got there and everyone got on the same page and then I invited this being in, the really interesting somatic, subjective, phenomenological part of this was that as soon as this thing got arrived, let's say, a bright strobing light began flashing behind my eyeballs, behind my eyelids. It was like someone had planted a strobe light at the base of my brain. And it was weirdly physical. My eyes watered profusely through the entire channeling section of the session. As soon as the strobe started going, my eyes were just watering profusely. She had the questions prepared. We recorded it all so I didn't have to try to track anything, just step out of the way and let this thing speak. And that strobing continued. And the way that you know, she'd ask a question and the way that the answers came were colors and shapes that morphed out of the strobing that was in the center of my brain and then would kind of spill into my brain, where they would then be converted or translated into verbal responses that could be verbalized, which were, I'm not going to go through the questions that I asked because I feel like the answers that I got actually clearly indicate what the question was to begin with, if that makes sense. So I'll just like quick bullet point through what the feedback, what the responses were from this entity within the context of this channeling session. The first was that my fear was perfectly okay, that they really didn't, it or its kind didn't really have any frustration about the fact that I couldn't go on the deck. I had a lot of embarrassment about that, just feeling shame, like, oh my God, this thing is probably really pissed off at me because it's been knocking on my astral door over my house here and I can't even bring myself to go out on the deck. So it's response around that was like, that's really not a problem. Like, we don't care you didn't go on the deck. Maybe you remember I showed up in your room on New Year's Eve. Like, buildings are not a hurdle. Buildings are not, if I wanted to be at the foot of your bed, I would be. So it was more a accommodating move, I stayed far away in order to accommodate the fear you're feeling. So it was more of like to try to cushion or buffer enough so that I wouldn't totally lose my shit, I guess. The second one, when I was asking about remember who you work for, the sentence that I put in my head, which I obsessed over for years and thought everything you can think about that. What does that mean? Remember who you work for? I work for you, or you know, what have I forgotten who I work for? Do I work for someone I don't know? So its response around that was an injunction, not a threat. Like, calm down. That wasn't a threat. That was an injunction. The injunction being remember for yourself who you work for. Then, basically asking around where they came from, what is the deal? Like the response being they come from a place ontologically distinct from my consensus physical reality, but they also have a presence on physical worlds, and Earth is among one of them. And within this, it was a very interesting sub-bundle, which as I tried to make sense of my waking state experiences and my dreaming experiences and deep dreamless states and meditative states, it showed me this idea that unlike human consciousness being compartmentalized or segmented into waking awareness and dreaming awareness and deep dreamless awareness, that it's not partitioned like that for them. This mantid entity was basically trying to say, like, imagine if all of those simultaneously were present to you at all times. If you were living in all three of those domains simultaneously, coextensively, which I really can't do, but it's a very interesting thought experiment, of course. Next was around this really curious point that I've spent a lot of time and energy on, which is, what is the connection between these big 8-foot-tall mantid beings that are so figured and threaded through abduction and other contact events and the 2,400 species of insects that are on this planet? What is the deal there? And its response was that they seeded the world, they seeded Earth with the morphogenetic type of these insect species many, many tens and tens and tens of millions of years ago as a gift. And that basically, as I had suspected in the mantis insect synchronicities, they also can, for a time, briefly, they can literally control these insect beings and see through them. They can be like avatars, I guess, like micro tiny avatars for transient events in order for signaling to occur. So basically it was like, yeah, we were signaling you in each of those instances with the insects because we can control them temporarily in that fashion. The next was that they're not malevolent and that in fact they're protecting my family. The next was that there's a great disequilibrium in contact events. So it basically tried to show me that it takes 100 units of 100 increments of energy or effort for it to be face to face with me. For every one increment that I might expend to be face to face with it, that ratio was, it felt like that was really something it wanted to get across. Like it's a lot harder for them than it is for us, even with all the capacities they may be possessed of. The next was around time, that they experienced time very differently, that it wanted me to know it didn't experience my multiple lifetimes as a succession, that all of my incarnations were not a sequence to them that occurred in that real arrow of time that humans typically find as a part of our day-to-day life, you know, month-to-month stage of development experience. They also wanted me to know, you know, basically answering straightforward that yes, those nocturnal events were us and that they selected the reverse tuning fork and the hearing test because they really wanted something unmistakably undismissible. They basically wanted something that I wouldn't be able to dismiss. So that's why it was so invasively personal. And then the last one, which I found really interesting in a broader sense, was that alcohol is the biggest block to my professed desire for deeper understanding and connection and conscious interaction. Basically, it was showing me, like, you know, on the one hand, you're saying you want conscious interaction, but on the other hand, you're drinking all the time in order to just totally knock yourself offline, which is completely true. And I basically discovered, I don't think at all that I'm the first person to discover this. I shouldn't even use the word discover. I think this is more like old hat for experiencers, which is at some point you come across the little technology where you're like, oh, if I get blackout drunk, I'm really no good to them. Like they can't, it's pointless. So they just leave you alone, right? And which is basically the chemotherapy approach to inhibiting or governing contact. And so its point was like, that, yes, that really knocks out the interaction, but it's incredibly destructive. And you're basically beating the shit out of yourself in order to delay or forestall the inevitable. Because it won't stop contact. It will just delay it. And you're hurting yourself. So could you possibly get curious about other approaches? And that was the channeling session in a nutshell. And when I came out of that, very, very impressed physically, somatically by the watering of the eyes and the strobe light effect. Because as soon as we're done channeling, the strobing stopped and my eyes stopped watering. The shaman had all of the kinds of things that she reported as well from her perspective that she thought were attendant to the channeling. You know, ultimately, did that give me some satisfying, conclusive resolution on all of this? I would say no. I would say, along with so much that comes within these very surreal, transrational set of riddles and experiences, new questions emerged from that. That definitely facilitated me deepening the way that I live the questions, but I have never experienced some satisfying conclusion to all of it where I just sort of brush my hands and go, cool, we're done with that. You know, I'm good with that now. Like, didn't go that way at all. My wife and I had one more really remarkable sighting together, which again, I feel so grateful that so many or most of my experiences have been shared. My wife and I were on the deck again with our kids having a conversation about death. This is the most meaningful and vulnerable, exposed conversation that my wife and I had ever had with our kids about death. It was really emotional. Someone close to us all had just passed. We were all working our way through it, grieving together. And it was one of those raw, unmasked, you know, unfiltered, just true, true raw emotion. And it was powerful for all of us. And when we finished the conversation, my kids went downstairs and my wife and I were lying on our backs, just looking up at the sky. And this green, billowing, cylindrical, it looked like it was on fire, but it wasn't on fire. It looked more like plasma. It was about 10, 12 feet long, maybe 2 feet in diameter, cylindrical shaped. And it moved from south to north directly in front of our, maybe 12 or 15 feet in front of our faces. Slow. I could have easily taken a couch cushion and hit it. Although it looked like a deep sea creature or something. It had that kind of bioluminescent billowing. It really looked alive. And it slowly passed right over the top of our deck. And it just crossed south to north. And we sat up and watched it recede into the tree line that's on the other side of the neighborhood. And then it was out of sight. And again, has become the pattern in our life. I immediately, you know, I just electrified. I made my wife go downstairs and write down everything, describe everything she'd seen, document it before we even talked about it. And, you know, then we came back up and talked about it and we saw exactly the same thing and independently documented all that. And there again, what do I know about that? I don't know what that was. I'm never going to know what that was. I know that it arrived and presented itself. It displayed itself moments after this conversation about death. It seemed alive. It did not, it's unlike anything I've ever seen in my entire life. There's nothing I could compare it to other than the descriptors I've already shared. And my wife, in her true, honest response, you know, once we had talked about it and confirmed that we'd seen the same thing, and I was just so alighted with this exuberance and wonder. And she said, I can't talk about this. It stops my brain. And she didn't mean that in a mean way at all. It's just, I totally get it. She literally means this stops my brain. I cannot comprehend what we just saw, and I'm never going to comprehend it. So please, can we stop talking about it? Can you talk to someone else about it? Which is fair enough. I honestly feel like her pragmatic connection to and loyalty to this realm is probably one of the reasons that I've been able to hold on to more of a workable truce with this realm, because I'm much more naturally toward the other end. So we saw that together. And then beyond that, you know, I, as you know, went on to make a podcast and form the Experiencer Group. And one of the things that came from sharing my story initially when I came out of the closet, I did it on Coast to Coast and just like said, screw it. Let's like skip to the, go right to the car chase here. And I'll just like go on with George, not George Norrie, George Knapp. And so doing that, what was most important about coming out of the closet and just telling that story was that I started to hear from so many other Mantid entity experiencers from all over the world. It's just like, I know, as you know, Nick, from your show, that you, there's a deluge, there's an avalanche that happens. And so for me, I was so moved and transported and gratified by all of these Mantid entity experiencers. And honest to God, I mean, 99% of everyone I've heard from, they don't want to be on a show. They don't want any publicity. They don't want anyone to know their name. They literally just want someone to hear what happened to them. And they're living somewhere where they don't have a support system, or they're in a family that's not amenable to the subject. There's my dog I was telling you about. He's protecting my house finally now that the anomalies are gone. But so the community around, you know, even this subset, as specific as Mantid entities, finding, oh, these experiences are all over the world. They come from every demographic you could think of. They're from every country, every language, every cultural set of condition. This is a worldwide phenomenon, and it is much more multifaceted, much more prismatic than just, and I'm not dismissing this, I'm not discounting this because it's important, but it's more than just a Mantid entity at the head of a great room overseeing operations during abductions, although that's really important. And that's perhaps the way most of us know them, what most of us know them from. But boy, the other variety, variation, and spectrum that I've heard of the kinds of Mantid entity encounters and experiences has really, really blown my mind. And the last one that I'll share, which is not mine, but pertains to my event in 2010 on New Year's Eve, was that as I was researching my own experiences and trying to make sense of finding counts and resources that fall within the rubric of this kind of thing, I came across the account of someone named Jacqueline Smith, who was presenting at the 2016 UFO conference. And I was watching this video, and out of nowhere, she says, and I had Mantis entities visit me on New Year's Eve at 12 noon. Same exact as mine, except instead of 12 midnight, it was 12 noon. So again, you know, at that point, I just put down my laptop and start walking around the house, go over to my wife, and I'm like, you want to hear something? You know, she knows the look on my face, and she's like, do I? I don't know. Do I? I'm like, I just found someone who also had a Mantis entity experience on New Year's Eve at 12 noon instead of 12 midnight. You know, and she's, my wife is like, please don't call her. Please just let it go. Please just, but I couldn't, of course. And so I contacted her and got her account as well. And that I would say in closing on relating the general landscape of that little decade window is that the great, great good that has come from it is the human relationships that I've had. And certainly the manner in which it has expanded my own sense of wonder, the profound impact it's had on my creativity and my artistry. But the community that I've found of other experiencers is really beautiful and life-changing. And I feel like I discovered hundreds of new heroes and heroines where it's almost as though, I know you can relate to this because I've listened to every episode of your show and I've so many of the accounts on here. When people share, my feeling is just like, oh my gosh, what people live through and do beautiful things with, what people live through and find a way to have it deep in their humanity is infinitely spectacular to me. And so, yeah, I have a great appreciation for your work. I appreciate being able to share my story and experiences on the show.
Now, Stuart, you are the host of a popular podcast called Aliens and Artists. Now, for our listeners that haven't had a chance to listen yet, where can they find your podcast?
Anywhere you listen to podcasts, so all the Apple, Stitcher, any platform carries podcasts will have Aliens and Artists. And we're about, I guess, a year and a half, coming up on 2 years in a while here. And it's basically a show about how contact with non-human entities impacts human creativity. But it's a really broad umbrella. Everything from all realms of art, from painting, music, sculpture, theater, film, TV, whatever, but even much more broadly, any creative human endeavor. And most human endeavors, as we all know, are very creative. So it's, yeah, it's about human creativity and non-human contact. And it's been really deeply gratifying, the guests.
And you're also the founder of the Experiencer Group, the support group.
Yeah, that's correct. So the Experiencer Group, it's young. We launched in late February and we're just getting our sea legs. We were in beta for a while, but we are wide open to the public now. And it's really unique. It's a closed membership site for experiencers of all kinds of anomalous phenomena. So this is not just aliens, UFOs, UAP. This is precognition, near-death experience, out-of-body, astral travel, clairvoyance, clairaudience, lucid dreaming, spiritual practices. This is a real big tent for all kinds of anomalous experience. And the idea is, number one, the doors are closed. So we vet the people who come in. We make sure that we can build a positive, supportive, anomalous culture. There's no trolls. There's no stigma. And within the site, each of these respective interests, from the occult to precognition to abduction, they all have their own group headings. And when you come in, you can do a smorgasbord. You can pick what you like. You can join two groups or five or six, whatever you prefer, and tailor it to your own interest and your own experiences. And then beyond that, we have support groups, typically one or two a week, with people from all over the world. I mean, I don't know how many countries are represented in our membership now, but it's dozens. And on any given support call, you might have seven or eight countries represented. So it's people all over the world. The support calls are deep. They go 2 to 3 hours each. We also have book clubs. We also have happy hours. We have all kinds of meetups. So, and we have our first retreat coming up in person in September in Boulder. So we're also moving to 3D person to person. And really, in a nutshell, Nick, it's like it's built by experiencers for experiencers so they can get love and connection and the support that they need.
That's wonderful. And it is needed as well, Stuart.
So much so. I mean, gosh, I don't know, but I know that you've heard from hundreds and hundreds of people, and I've heard from so many folks as well. And I feel like the experience so many of them have is that they're alone and they're isolated. There's no one like them, and they're never going to be able to find someone who can understand what they've been through. And this community is that for those people, myself included, very much.
So if you're out there listening for your next podcast, I suggest you certainly check out Stuart's Aliens and Artists. I subscribed a long time ago. Wonderful.
It's a thrill to be here with you, Nick. I just love your work and love what you're doing. So thank you for the opportunity to be on the show. And just know you've got an open invitation to come on Aliens and Artists anytime in perpetuity.
That would be great. I will do that.
Fantastic.
If you want to reach out to Stuart at all links are down below in the show notes, as always.
All right, brother. Well, thank you so much for this. I really appreciate it.
Stuart, I really appreciate you coming on.
Cosmic hugs, brother.
Cosmic hugs.
Okay. Have a great day, Nick. Thanks.
And you. Take care of yourself. That is all for this week. Keep updated and connected with the show on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And if you have an encounter that you would like to share on the podcast, please email me at ufochronicles@gmail.com or reach out to me via the contact page on my website at ufochroniclespodcast.com. Big thank you to Stuart for sharing tonight, and thank you for listening. I will be back on Thursday, so stay safe and keep watching the skies. Goodbye.